Opinions expressed therein are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
Good morning, Fairbanks. You're listening to KFAR Radio. We're at 660 on the AM dial, 97 on the FM dial, 97.5 on the FM dial, and we live stream at kfarradio.com. This is Problem Corner. I'm your host, David Pruse. If you have a question or want to call in to today's guest, we're at 907-458-TALK, 907-458-8255. And with that, I found Nick Nugent, who was disappeared on me last Wednesday. Nick, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. Certainly better than last Wednesday.
Don't ever scare the crap out of me like that again, my friend. God, you know, I've become my dad. You know, I'm going, it's a quarter till. Where's Nick? This is out of bounds. Where's Nick at? You know, and it's 10 till. Where's Nick? It's when till the hour. What's wrong? Where's Nick? Is Nick okay? I'm texting you. I'm calling you. There's no answer. 11:15, Nick texts me, something about a clock.
Yeah. At the time you called me, I thought it was 10 a.m., and I was getting dressed, getting ready to come in.
And then I ought to be retired.
Yeah, it does kind of slow us down a bit.
Well, what the heck. I'm glad you're fine. You're okay. But it was just, you know, it was so out of bounds for you. You know a person's personality and their structure, and there's something wrong. What's wrong with Nick? You know, so I was going nuts. And so when you texted in, during the show, I smiled. I go, I'm going to get that guy. So, okay, we're good. But what's today's show about, sir?
Well, we're going to talk about Wesley, your old uncle. He was a geologist and engineer for the Kennecott Mines. You know, we've talked a lot about prospectors. We've talked a lot about small miners. Mm-hmm. This is a fellow that worked for one of the biggest mines ever in the state, and he was up in his position. He was part of, he was kind of a valuable cog in the whole process. So, just to introduce the Kennecott properties, if you'll notice throughout this paper, I have Kennecott spelled two ways, with an E and with an I. The E is the official way that the company misspelled it. And that name stuck. There was a typing error. So actually, Kennecott, with an I, was the original.
What's in a name?
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, that's where the Kennecott Corporation had their beginning. It's located on the east side of the Kennecott Glacier at an elevation of about 2,200 feet. And the glacier runs pretty much north-south. About 16 miles, and there's a huge ice field that it terminates in up at the 13,000 to 16,000 foot level. I believe you were sheep hunting just on the north side of this
property. I was right where the Kennecott Mountains where the Wrangell Mountains meet the Mentasta Mountains.
Okay.
That's where I was at, right there. You know, there are two perpendicular mountain ranges that run, sure. You know, you got a valley between them, and that's right where I was at.
You probably could have got on a high enough peak and just about seen where we're talking about.
Exactly, yeah. I was, the Nombesna mine was down the road from me. So,
well, the terminus of the glacier lies 4 miles then below the town site of McCarthy. Three creeks, National, Jumbo, and Bonanza, form near McCarthy. They form the Kennecott River, which flows to the Nizina. That river joins the Chitna, which joins the Copper River, eventually flowing to tidewater at Cordova. Well, the early Russian explorers noted the local natives had items made of copper, but they were so focused on the fur trade, they paid no attention to that. Later, the United States sent Lieutenant Abercrombie, 1884. His attempt to ascend the river was made, After 2 months, they'd only reached the Childs and Miles glaciers, an advance of only 20 miles. Lieutenant Allen came next in 1885, and he came earlier in the year, so he missed some of the high water, which would have been caused by glacial melt, which did affect Abercrombie's attempts. But remember, we presented Abercrombie one day, and mm-hmm. he was a little bit of a humbug. So,
yes, he was.
Well, there were USGS members, and they pulled a sample, and that sample assayed at about 60% copper, so really high, good-grade ore.
Good yield, my goodness.
Now, they then were able to report enough to guide future prospectors who would begin to arrive in 1898, 1898 being a pivotal year, not only for everyone going to Dawson, but everyone getting to Dawson, finding out there was nothing to do, and then spreading out all over Alaska since they were here and they were ready to go look for prospects. Also along on this expedition was a young Stephen Birch, who became a driving force later in the mines. So the Nikolai mine, the first discovered, named after Chief Nikolai, was discovered 1899 and is likely the ore body shown Lieutenant Allen by Chief Nikolai.
One quick question. How did they get the name Kennecott? Where'd that come from?
Okay, you got me on the one. One of the early party members was named Kennecott.
Okay.
One of the early explorers. And
okay.
I've just lost which one that was. It's a big name. You think I'd remember.
His name's Kennecott, yeah. So it's, what the heck? And it's with an I, not an E.
That's correct.
Okay.
So it was owned by the Chittenden Mining and Exploration. That group was returning in 1900 to start development of their property. Two members of the party, Jack Smith and Clarence Warner, separated from the group near what was the town site of McCarthy. They swung around the east side of the glacier, and as they traveled, they recognized the ore body contact as described by the USGS. They traveled up Bonanza Creek and discovered the ore body at about 4,000 feet elevation. This was early August 1900, and to their credit, they immediately ran back to their party and brought them over to see the better ore.
We already got a phone call. You ready?
I am.
Good morning. You're on KFAR Radio with Nick Nugent, and your name is?
Did you say Robert Kennecott?
You just said Kennecott. Is it Robert Kennecott?
Yes.
So anyway, he was with the Smithsonian first. He walked into where Fort Yukon is from the north. Also with the Russian-American Telegraph.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Charles. Yeah.
Okay. Bye.
Appreciate that, buddy. You take care. Bye.
And we just talked about the Russian-American Telegraph 3 months ago. Age is getting me.
Well, we give a plethora of information. We can't retain it all.
There you go. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I'm with you on this one.
So, Arthur Spencer then described this area in the USGS publication Geology and Mineral Resources of a Portion of the Copper River. That's online. There's a USGS warehouse site, and you can download that. It's an enjoyable read if you're interested in the Copper River country.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the claims staked by the party stretched for nearly a mile along the geological contact. The ore body was massive, though not very well understood. A sample they took, and unfortunately they don't say what size the sample was, yielded 70% copper and 14 ounces of silver. It's a remarkable silver output.
Basically, 85% was money.
Yes. That wouldn't be too bad a briar patch to fall in.
No.
So about a mile northeast then of the Bonanza was a small surface outcrop about 15 feet long by 12 feet thick. There was a lot of malachite ore up there. It was very bright green. They walked over to see if it happened to be grass to feed their animals on and found all the ore.
There you go.
Which I thought was kind of funny, mistaking it for grass at that distance. Well, That was the jumbo, and that outcrop was the surface expression, that small piece, of what became the greatest copper producer of all four of the mines. Tremendous amount of copper there. Well, Birch was back in Valdez when the members of the exploring party returned in the fall of 1900. He was pretty impressed by what they brought back with them, and when one of the members turned out to be a little cash short, Birch bought in and ended up with a 1/11th portion of the operation. Birch was this very determined, driven individual. After visiting the site, he never wavered in his attempts to control the prospects and get mining going there. Birch had been bankrolled by wealthy friends, and those friends had contacts with the Guggenheims. So the company that Birch ends up working with was the Guggenheim-Morgan combination, also known as the Lasca Syndicate. In 1908, the ownership passed to the Kennecott Mines Company, which reorganized in 1915 as the Kennecott Copper Corporation. Birch was president. So now we actually get to Dunkel. I needed to set a little bit of background.
Yeah.
But from 1910 to 1929, the Kennecott Copper Corporation employed Wesley Earl Dunkel through their exploration arm, the Alaska Development and Mineral Company. According to what the company was doing, his employer would often be listed as the Beatson Copper Company, Midas Copper Company, Bering River Coal Company, and even the Alaska Steamship Company.
He wore a lot of hats.
He did, but it also shows you the influence the Guggenheims had in Prince William Sound.
Yeah, they were in heavy.
Yep. They'll be a subject we should probably do over the course of a couple of programs.
That, I would love to do that. You know, the Guggenheim, the trusts,
yes.
You know, the syndicates that came up and started the early developments from about 1890 on.
The battle of the Guggenheims with others for control of the Dawson Fields, the Gold Hustlers, is a really good book on the subject.
I've read that book, yeah. I've got that book at home.
Very interesting.
That fills in a lot of things.
It does. And they owned most of the dredging properties out at Flat.
Mm-hmm.
So he was doing whatever his employer needed. These were all part of the Alaska Syndicate. And Dunkel, in a series of later interviews, just simplified it by saying he had worked for Stephen Birch, and Birch was considered to be the major part of the success of the Kennecott Mines. He was 15 years older than Dunkel and heavily involved with the operations of the mines and often in the field. So he brought Dunkel along, and Dunkel, in later interviews, shows a lot of respect for Birch. Well, backtracking just a bit, Dunkel was born on March 4th, 1887, in Clarendon, PA. A German family. Just before the War of 1812, they moved to western Pennsylvania for better agricultural lands. They moved near Warren, PA. And in 1905, he entered the Sheffield Scientific School of Yale University. He graduated in 1908 as a mining engineer. He was inducted into the scientific honorary fraternity, Sigma Chi, and he was class vice president during his senior year of 1908. And while at Yale, one of the things he excelled in athletics, particularly crew or rowing, and he competed in decathlon. So he was a person of varied interest. He was very talented in music. He was a member of the mandolin and banjo clubs. He was mentioned in news clippings in Alaska as playing the flute at age 66 in a number of public performances.
He's a very talented person.
He's one of those kind of, you know, what you might call a Renaissance person in some ways.
Yeah,
very much so. Well, the class of 1980 at Yale was one of its best mining classes. 51 men entered either mining or metallurgy. Several, including Dunkel, were quite exceptional. David D. Irwin and H.D. Smith, worked for a while at Kennecott Copper, and then they all met up in some African ventures later in their careers, as well as developing mines and oil fields in Mexico. So Dunkel began in the iron mines of the Mesabi Range in Minnesota at the Canisteo Mine. While there, he read of construction of the Copper River and Northwestern Railroad and the copper deposits of the Bonanza Lode, and he vowed to his co-workers that he was going to go there someday. His next stop was Ely, Nevada, and the McGill Smelter. There, he was also hired to be an assayer for another mine, the Veteran Mine, and that job made a real difference in his career because the mine manager was W.H. Seagrave, who had connections with Guggenheim Consultants. Seagrave had been one of Hammond's, one of the Guggenheim men's, superintendents at Robinson Deep Mine in the Witwater Sand of South Africa. The Guggenheims were the operating component then of the Alaska Syndicate, and at this time, the syndicate had just purchased a number of properties in Prince William Sound. So Seagrave was sent by Yearman's recommendation to manage the Beatson, which was a big mine. In July of 1910, Seagrave sent for Dunkel to come and work for him. He had been really impressed with working with him before. His initial job was at the Beatman property. He had the chance to visit the Copper River project at Childs Glacier near the Million Dollar Bridge. While there, he met Stephen Birch and made a very favorable impression on him. In the fall of 1911, Seagrave was moved to Kennecott as general manager of the Bonanza Mine. Dunkel that same year received his first senior position as lead engineer of the Alaska Development and Mineral Company. Well, part of his duties consisted of scouring properties which the syndicate may want to acquire. He also kept track of competing companies in the area. Later, he wrote this move had given him the opportunity to make the first detailed geologic study of the ore deposits in the Kennecott. So it was a busy move, but it was a good one. Either of those jobs would have...
We're going to take a commercial break. I forgot to do that. Fairbanks, so enthralled with this. We'll be back in a few minutes.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
So how's your memory? Can you remember this name? It's Living Waters Plumbing and Mechanical. It's pretty simple. But it's a name you want to be familiar with. You see, good plumbers who can get to your problem quickly and do a top-quality job, fixing it all at a reasonable price, well, let's simply say they're scarce. Living Waters Plumbing and Mechanical is quick to the problem, and they're quick to the solution. And when you have no heat, or you have a bad plumbing leak, your HVAC isn't working, or your pipes are frozen, you want your problem fixed. So who do you call? I told you to remember the name. It's Living Waters Plumbing and Mechanical. Boilers and water heaters, snow melt systems, of course, drain cleaning. They also own Victory Drains. And you'd be surprised how much more. So look, you don't have to try to remember the phone number. Just remember the name and look it up from there. One more time now. Say it with me. Living Waters. Right. Living Waters Plumbing and Mechanical. Okay, well done.
Ready to fix a great career for yourself? How'd you like to work in a fun and positive environment? Expressway Auto in North Pole is now expanding and is currently accepting positions for automotive and diesel technicians. Applicants should have at least 1 year of experience as well as the skills, knowledge, and attitude to excel. Additional certifications are a plus and can increase your earning power. Applications can be dropped off at Expressway Auto on the Richardson Highway in North Pole, or to schedule an interview, call 888-659-0631. Expressway Auto is an equal opportunity employer.
Dearest Mother, I've written in the past about visiting Brewster's. I once again went 2 evenings ago. More great food, generous portions, and it was quick to come out. I tried something new, mozzarella sticks. They were something I've never had before anywhere, and I will look forward to coming back to Brewster's to have them again. My server, of course, was delightful and was very attentive. Great service, great food. Plus, they have a bar. Mother, I will be back. Brewster's is one of the better restaurants in Fairbanks for dinner. Your beloved son, Henry.
KFAR weather.
Scattered rain showers likely today, otherwise cloudy skies. Highs around 45, northeast winds around 5 miles an hour. Scattered rain showers again tonight, lows level off around 37, cloudy. Highs around 44 tomorrow, chance for scattered showers. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Derek Height.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. Here with Nick Nugent. We're doing a little bit of history of Wesley Earl Dunkel, Kennecott Mines. And we've got a few minutes before our bottom of the hour break.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, like we said, Dunkel was a busy man. Either job that he had would have kept most people fully occupied. But from 1912 to 1916, he examined 106 mining properties for the Alaska Development and Mineral Corporation. Dunkel wasn't restricted to Prince William Sound in the Wrangell Mountains either. He examined properties in Cook Inlet, southeastern Alaska, the Kenai Peninsula, and Broad Pass. In 1913, he examined 25 properties in three districts of British Columbia. Commodities range from iron and coal to lead, zinc, and silver. He also took a two-month journey to the new goldfields at Shoshana. On his travels, he went by foot, boat, horseback, and in winter by dog sled. Well, there's an account of his Broad Pass trip, which began in late February of 1915. Dunkel and his new wife of 2 months, Florence, mushed across the ice of Upper Cook Inlet to Kinnick. Florence, prior to marriage, had been the secretary for Stephen Birch in Cordova, which is how they met. During the prior year, 25 prospectors had staked a section of land about a mile by a half mile long, and they were going up the Susitna to check this property out. At Kinnick, 4 tons of supplies awaited, although all of his scientific gear had been left in Seward. So he and his wife turn around to head back, and they mushed to ice-free Goose Bay, and there hired Captain Sam Kramer with a gas launch, the Traveler. The first day took them to Ship Creek. The following day, they were caught by tidal ice and stuck for 5 days, moving back and forth with the ice. They broke free of it. The run to Seward should have taken only 2 more days. In fact, it took 5. They ran into a gale. Dunkel and Kramer made for Port Dick, which was a calm anchorage, and they fought 35-foot tidal rips during part of this time. Florence mentioned she was only able to hold down a couple of oranges during this part of the trip.
Oh, my goodness.
It just shows you that even the guys, you know, the engineers, the office people, the scientific staff, when you were in Alaska in those days, everybody had the same hardships traveling.
There is no first class.
Not a bit. Dunkel, it turns out, survived ship and train wrecks and at least 7 airplane crashes, and he did more solo crossings of glacial streams than anyone would have deemed possible.
Oh. They don't make him like they used to.
No, very, very active person. So it was.
That was his normal form coming up here. That was the norm.
Yeah, you know, guys that just went out and walked distances that seem unbelievable to us. And, you know, imagine if you'd been on your hunting trip and you'd been wearing those knee-high lineman boots. Weigh 10 pounds a boot like you see people have.
Yeah, and then the type of backpacks they had, the old freighters, yep. You know, and if it was literally a backpack,
yep.
And, you know, with wood frame.
And wool was warm. Certainly carrying that much weight would warm you up.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a break here. We're going to give you some bumper music. Robert Palmer, Addicted to Love. I can't wait for this one. Then we're going to have some Fox News, some state news, some commercial, and we'll be back.
Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fox News, I'm John Saucier. President Biden meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today in New York. First time since the Israeli leader returned to office last year.
Even where we have some differences, my commitment to Israel, as you know, is ironclad.
Well, back in Washington, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy asked about how talks are going at a funding deal to keep the government open.
I feel like we are. The members are already in meeting. I think we're making some progress. We made some progress last night. Look, it's not September 30th. The game is not over, so we continue to work through it. And I've been at this place many times before, and we're going to solve this problem.
There are a group of Republicans, though, who oppose even an interim spending bill to keep the government funded through October. Their concern here is this bill would just extend Democratic spending levels. They want to see spending cuts. America is listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
Alaska's news source reports fire hydrant flushing in Kotzebue has left some residents there experiencing discoloration of their tap water. Brown water, and you could smell it. It was terrible, Kotzebue resident Trudy Kenworthy said. It smelt like probably fecal matter. Kotzebue Public Works Director Russell Ferguson said the annual hydrant flushing causes twice the amount of normal water to run through the water mains. The flushing, which is designed to ensure the hydrants are fully operational in the event of a fire, scours the water pipes, which contain built-up minerals such as magnesium and iron. But Ferguson said there is another factor at play this year with the city's darker-than-normal water, and that is manganese. The darker-than-normal color this year is due to the dissolved manganese not being fully removed from the water prior to chlorination. This is due to the oxidization not operating as efficiently as planned, Ferguson wrote in an email. Ferguson said the level of manganese in the Kotzebue water system is not a health threat, and that if residents are experiencing discolored water, they should run the water until it's clear.
Streaming live online at KFAR660.com.
See your world in perfect focus. Keep your eyes in perfect health. Visit optometrist Dr. Rebecca Wilbur for comprehensive family vision care, children's eye care, and emphasis on medical eye disease. An Alaskan native, Rebecca speaks fluent Yupik with a heartfelt desire to serve the Native community. Schedule your appointment. Call the Eye Clinic of Fairbanks team of ophthalmologists, optometrists, and opticians providing medical and surgical eye care, prescription lenses, fashion eyewear, your eye health professionals on Mini Street. Visit eyeclinicoffairbanks.com.
Did you miss your favorite local show on KFAR Radio? Just log on to our website, kfarradio.com, and click the Archives tab to find all past episodes of shows like Problem Corner, Health Talk, Fairbanks Foodies, Alaska Realty Today, Shooter's Corner, and the Compos Outdoor Show. Hours of entertaining, informative, local programs produced exclusively for KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Online at kfarradio.com. We are KFAR, the heartbeats of Alaska.
Nowadays, nothing is more important than saving money. And the best way to do that is with the radio station's 50-50 Friday offer. Every week, a different special from a different local business, offering gift certificates at half price. All from your favorite restaurants, shops, and events. So what's this week's 50-50 Friday offer?
This week's 50-50 goes out to Evergreen Eatery. Evergreen Eatery is timelessly delicious, known for their elevated pug food, their flatbreads, sliders, whip feta dipper, chicken wings, gourmet fries and beer cheese, breakfast, brunch, and lunch all served up to perfection from Evergreen Eatery. Get your $25 gift certificate this Friday for only half off. Let them feed your taste buds at 150 Eagle Avenue, Unit B, next door to Lat 65. Evergreen Eatery is this week's 50-50.
Just log on to this station's website and click on that red 50-50 tag in the upper right-hand corner. Have your credit card ready and get ready to save big. 50-50 Friday, every Friday at 9 a.m. from the radio station.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back in the studio here with Nick Nugent, who made it today. Sorry, buddy. Don't do that to me again. Not that you're never late, but you worried the heck out of me.
No, well, like I say, if anything looks like my Wednesday morning's going to go bad, I'll come and camp out at the studio on Tuesday night.
Oh, goodness. So we're talking Wesley Earl Dunkel of the Kennecott Mines, geologist engineer. He's a man. They just don't make him like they used to.
And you know, along that line, one of the things that's interesting, Dunkel only had $10 a month personal expenses. The reason being, he was such a personable fellow that all kinds of people would transport him and house him and feed him for free just to have him around to talk to.
And I thought, well, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
Well, this guy, yeah, I can see that. Let me play the flute for you, or the mandolin, you know, or something like that, or the cello.
Yeah, they must have. It must have been like having five or ten regular.
Yeah, Walter Cronkite walk onto your ship or into your cabin. You know, let me tell you the news.
Exactly. Well, Dunkel related that he was so busy, a lot of times he had to sort out when he had been at a location by events that happened then. One, for instance, is he was at looking at the W.A. Dickey's copper prospect at Landlocked Bay when news of the April 1912 sinking of the Titanic came in. On another trip, he traveled to Cold Bay, then to Chignik, where he boarded the ship the Dora, a little steamship, and they were coming back on June 6th, 1912. In the afternoon, the Dunkel and Captain McMullen were enjoying the scenery when Mount Katmai exploded.
Oh, boy.
And that's actually something we ought to talk about someday, too, the amount of things.
You're bringing up lots of work that we can do, lots of info, of shows.
Next month's our fourth anniversary. Let's aim for four more.
There you go. I like how you think.
So the Dora,
I'm in.
The Dora was a 350-ton steamer. Interestingly, the skies turned dark. 18 inches of pumice covered the deck. And then, at one point, thousands of birds landed on the ship because they were totally confused with all of the pumice, the darkness, and everything. They just started landing on the ship thinking it was a rock. Well, back in Cordova then, Dunkel gave one of the first reports of the event to a reporter for the Cordova Daily Alaskan. You can find that newspaper on Newspapers, Inc., and it has this wonderful, you know, end-of-the-world type, mountain explodes, lurid lights, lightning storms, and it just, I thought, wow, nothing like the jingoistic press, if you will. Well, between all these scouting trips, as you'd think he wouldn't have had a minute's worth of time, but Dunkel was either in Seattle, Cordova, or at the mines. In later years, he had greater successes, but he said these years were never surpassed for satisfaction as a geologist.
Okay, yeah.
And he was involved in the controversy of the origin of chalcocite. He helped discover the Jumbo ore body and orchestrated the acquisition of the Motherlode property. In 1912, when he first came, the Bonanza was the only known ore body. There were claims along the fissure, but it was essentially barren along that outcrop. Birch wanted to have a pretty high power opinion to know what to go forward with, so they went ahead and they contracted with a geologist from Harvard. He then looked at the ore and came up with a number of decisions. He basically decided the ore would diminish the farther away from the source you got. The ore was thought to be a replacement ore that, through various geochemical events, transformed the original ore and would leach out the copper. That wasn't true here. There's a geologist who worked for the Houghton, Alaska mine, Oka Potter. He was pretty sure the control was in the fissures, but he didn't know how to find that out. So he snuck across the glacier at night, entered the mining works at 1:30 while the mine crew was asleep, went down a small shaft, which is pretty bold, and found extremely rich ore. He decided that all the existing literature was wrong and that the ore body then ran across the mountains, and they needed to restake Kennecott Copper Corporation's claims because they were facing wrong
direction.
Direction to take full advantage. A lot of complicated rules on underground mining, and they were basically about 90 degrees out of phase.
He did this on his own whim, Lark. He probably had discussions with people, and they're probably saying no, no, no.
Yeah, he went over to see what he could find out to see if he could help his own property, And as a matter of fact, not so much. But what they found out, the way the ore body was laid out, back at the Bonanza, they changed their mining or their exploration technique, and they started running long adits parallel to the fissure, and then running over side adits over to the fissure. And that's when they found out that there was an ore body in some places 300 feet thick. It blasting uncovered more bodies 2 to 3 feet thick, and it continued toward the surface for at least 120 feet until it hit a fault. Cross-cutting at that point encountered an ore body worth $26 million in that day. So we can see why the Googies were. And that was right, that was found just before the major demand for copper in World War I exploded. They couldn't have had better timing.
Wow. It's better to be lucky than good.
No. Well, back in New York, Dunkel was having lunch with Birch and found out the Guggenheims were so busy with mining operations all over the world, they didn't realize they had a $26 million ore body. And he got to speak to some of Murray Guggenheim, and the jumbo discovery was really a result of good geologic theory and diligent work by the crews under Seagrave. Well, in this time, this mineral was thought again to be a secondary mineral. Dunkel held the theory they were in primary mineralization based on the fact that every sample he was able to get a hold of, no matter where it was pretty much identical in the amount of copper that was in it. So I told him, well, no, this isn't diminishing.
80%, yeah, and then, or 60% rather.
Well, this fellow from Harvard, Grayton, who was probably the preeminent mineralogist in the country at the time, Dunkel kind of takes him on, if you will. And I thought, yeah, that makes sense, a Yale versus Harvard battle.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So we know a little bit of what happened there. There was another problem, though, at the mother lode, which is the one they wanted to move into to really control the area. It had been discovered by a man named Warner and his partner Smith. The discoveries, they were the discoverers of the original. They claimed the deposit with a partner, Oscar Sale. Sale, the winter after, was swept under the ice on the Chittenah River. And he only survived when he was washed up to a sandbar in another hole in the ice and was able to crawl out. This event seems to have left Sale mentally unstable. And shortly after, he disappeared and was never heard from again.
Oh,
that,
boy.
That held up development of the mother lode until he could be legally declared dead, which would be 7 years. So kind of a curious little string of events going on here.
Patience, my friend.
Well, Dunkel started serious work of the geologic factors and controls. He knew what was going on, that it occurred along very steep northeast trending fissures rather than being more vertical like they had originally thought. So that was the idea was to claim narrow and as long as you could.
We're going to take a quick commercial break.
Sure.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Did you know that hot weather is worse for your car than cold? It's true. Extreme heat can evaporate your battery's fluids and cause corrosion. If you're having a hard time starting your engine, visit Batteries Plus. We'll test your battery free of charge. We have plenty of replacement batteries on hand. Plus, we offer installation on most makes and models, or upgrade to Premier installation for added protection. Stop by your nearest location or shop our selection online at batteriesplus.com.
Count on Frontier Outfitters' extensive shooting department for what you need on your next hunt. Rifles and shotguns by Winchester, Remington, Browning, and more. Handguns by Smith & Wesson, Ruger, and many others. Ammunition and reloading supplies as well. Protect and transport your guns with cases by Pelican and gun boots by Colpin. Be on target with optics by Weaver, Bushnell, and Leopold. Your successful hunt begins with a trip to Frontier Outfitters. For Alaskan proven outdoor gear and clothing, trust Frontier Outfitters for your Alaskan lifestyle.
Hi, I'm Dr. Kim Dreffmeyer, board-certified and fellowship-trained spine surgeon. With my military experience and specialty spine training, I've been helping Alaskans suffering from neck, back, and sciatica problems for almost a decade now. Our spine team here at McKinley Orthopedics, Sports Medicine, and Spine has seven spine care specialists, including Drs. Malcolm and Wright, who offer OMM. We provide epidural injections as well as regenerative medicine, have in-house MRI and physical therapy, and offer procedures in Fairbanks, North Pole, and even Anchorage. Walk-ins are always welcome and no referral necessary. McKinley, your Fairbanks spine care specialist.
Weather brought to you by Bigfoot Pumping and Thawing, offering 24-hour service from Salcha to Nanana and no mileage charge on callouts. The Bigfoot with the helping hand. Bigfoot Pumping and Thawing.
KFAR weather.
High temperatures reach up to 45 today. Under cloudy skies with scattered rain showers likely. Northeasterly winds around 5 miles per hour. Overcast skies tonight. Scattered rain showers likely. Lows dip down to about 37. Chance for scattered rain showers tomorrow. Highs level off around 44. Cloudy skies expected. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. Got Nick Nugent in the studio here with me. How you doing, sir?
Very well.
You know, this is another heck of a person in Alaska history. And that mining area down there, you know, boy.
It was incredibly rich. I don't know that, I believe only in South America have they ever found larger deposits, but I believe there have never been deposits found that were more uniformly payor.
Yeah.
So, well, as the relations with the mother lode soured a bit, Dunkel was shut out of there, which caused him some problems working backward to find out what he needed to for the Bonanza. They did discover that they were taking ore at 1,000 to 1,100 feet above the geologic contact, and that meant there was 900 feet of this ore below them. So, you know, an eighth of a mile.
Yeah. Yeah.
So through the winter of 1913-14, it was really discussed at high company levels, and they decided to take a conservative course on new acquisitions at this time to minimize losses if Grayton were right. They deferred the purchase of the mother lode, and that cost them. At the time, because the mother lode was so tied up and uncertain, shares were available at 10 to 15 cents each. By the time Kennecott Copper had a controlling interest in the mother lode in 1919, the price was up to $18 per share. Dunkel didn't actually enter the mother lode till 1924 after he had left and come back. They were already operating it. He said he noted an ore body of almost solid mineralized material, 1,000 feet long, 80 feet wide, and hundreds of feet thick. So again, just ore that would be staggering. They decided, though, there were metallurgy problems with ore processing. So they brought in a fairly brilliant guy, E.T. Stenard. He was a metallurgist working at their properties in Chile. He came to Kennecott at a salary of $500 a month, which was pretty good for 1916. Seagrave asked Dunkel what he thought. Remember Seagrave, the mine manager, mm-hmm. what he thought. And Dunkel's comment was, he's a pretty poor mill hand if he can't make money in this mill.
That's throwing down the gauntlet.
Yeah, just a bit.
If you can't make it the best in the world, forget it.
So Stenard arrived, and he solved the mining problems. And one of the things he did, he developed the first successful ammonia leaching plant and developed a chemical treatment that basically caused the carbonate ore to react closer to what the other ores did. He also had success with oil flotation processing. At this point, copper recovery rose to 95%. Stenard paid his way and was pretty well in with Birch, so things were moving around. Stenard started positioning himself to get a bigger piece of the company. He wanted Seagrave dismissed so he could put a person of his own in, which happened. When Seagrave was dismissed, Stenard moved to replace Dunkel with one of his men also, and he was working at Latouche at the time at the mining property there. And the miners liked him so well, they offered to go on strike and stay on strike till the company went away and left him alone. But he decided it would, rather than just keep fighting the same battle, it was easier to move on.
Yeah.
He left with Seagrave, and they went to an operation in Contact, Nevada. With the new processing, though, 1916 was Kennecott's best year, best ever year. Dunkel returned to the Kennecott Group by 1920 and was stationed at Pier 2 in Seattle, involved in property acquisition in Alaska, Canada, and all of the Northwest. 1923, he moved to Anchorage to manage some properties, Copper Mountain, which is in Mount McKinley Park, Denali Park now, and the Mabel in the Willow District. In 1924, he was back briefly to the Wrangells and saw the operation at the Motherlode for the first time. For unrecorded reasons, he returned to Contact, Nevada from 1925 to 27. He came back and researched Kantishna and Broad Pass. He consulted on other properties and pushed for Prince William Sound properties, pushed for the acquisition of several. In 1929, he took his longest and most complex examinations for Birch, spending 9 months in Africa, in the mining, South Africa, in the mining properties. It was a bit of a Yale and Kennecott reunion. A lot of his ex-Yale classmates and former Kennecott employees were there. The plan that the Guggenheims came up with was to buy into the operating company rather than acquiring the properties outright. So that, again, kind of left Dunkel without quite as much to do because the other companies had their staffs on hand. Well, the onset of the Great Depression made all these actions moot. They totally made no money in Africa and post-Depression sold all their interests. Dunkel permanently severed his connections with KCC, went on his own. He did maintain a cordial relationship with Birch until his death in 1940. And in his own words, he said he maintained a curious relationship with Stenard until Stenard's death in 1949. He had great success with the Lucky Shot mine, and that success and the extra money he had led to his becoming involved with aviation. He, Stephen Mills, Charlie Rattan, and Jack Waterford founded Star Air Service, which is one of the processors to Alaska Airlines. His wife Florence passed in 1931, and he was remarried 2 years later. Unfortunately, the odds in mining run toward failure. Dunkel lost big in properties he had at Flat. He tried to operate the Golden Zone. It opened in 1941, was a good property, but it suffered from the war economy when gold mining was cut out. He opened his final operation was a coal mine up in Broad Pass, and he had a very, very innovative and good coal dryer, which saved a lot of money on operations. On September 29th, he went out to do some exploring to see what a water source for that processing plant might be, and he never returned. After a massive search, his body was found by two friends under a few inches of snow, so he had died on the trail. Well, Dunkel left a great legacy, if not in material goods, certainly in a life well-lived and diligently pursued, which benefited Alaska greatly.
He lived life. Explorer. Yeah. He was an explorer.
Yeah, he really, with a lot of the trips he did out,
an engineer valuing,
valuing the properties, somebody may have, he didn't have to go look for the properties necessarily with no idea there was something there, but he certainly went out to see what they were worth and do a true evaluation and prospect.
So what are we doing next month?
Next
October.
Month?
October.
October. Well, I've been looking
History at... History of Oktoberfest in Fairbanks?
Well, I don't know that we would fill a full hour with what I know about that.
Me neither, but I saw a couple of the places doing the St. Paula Girl mug contest yesterday.
Okay.
They're getting ready for them. I didn't see it, but they were getting ready for it, so it was fun talking with the Hoodoo Brewery and a couple of places like that. But what are you thinking for in October?
Maybe Slate Creek up in the Wiseman District. It's a very interesting story. A number of diaries have been found that we can work out of. A little bit of a spoiler alert here. Everything was going really, really wonderfully when a flood came through and washed away all of their pay dirt.
Oh.
And actually spread it downstream onto other claims.
Oh. God.
So, but it's a good story, even knowing in advance. But it's like mining, and like you said here, the odds run toward failure.
Yeah.
Then maybe come back to McCarthy. I could mention when we were talking offline, there are a few subjects in the Copper River Northwestern Railroad. The town of McCarthy is an interesting subject.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll try to start looking, see what I can find about the area you were hunting in. That's an area that we don't talk about too much, Nabisna, Shoshana, those areas.
I really enjoyed it. It was a beautiful country. And, you know, you go to Tok, you take a ride at the Tok Cutoff, and go down about 100 miles, and you turn left on the Nabisna Road, and you start going back in, and from there you get on a trail, and then you get off the trail, and, you know, you put your backpack on and go in farther, and then you make your camp, and you start sheep hunting, and you go in farther.
Prior to the forming of the Wrangell-St. Elias Park, mm-hmm. National Park, I remember that was a very, very productive and well-used area back in maybe the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
A lot of people went there, and I think they kind of overhunted it.
I have a photo of me at the monument where the park ends and the preserve starts.
Okay.
Yeah. And interesting, beautiful area. And, you know, you can still see mining operations that are in that area. Again, we're a resource-rich state. And if you look at what we talk about, it's usually about people that are after resources or resources that presented themselves or just the exploration. And then they saw the resources there as they're exploring.
Some of the early parties that came into the Tananaw came up the Chittenah River or mm-hmm. some of the others, came around the end of the mountains there and actually entered the Tananaw drainage from the White River drainage on Snag River, Snag Creek.
Came to the north.
Yeah, and so pretty big loop around if you think about it. You know, the Isabel Pass wasn't really discovered until Kastner in 1898. It just somehow was missed all that time.
Yeah, there was a pass that brought us from the Wrangells into the Mentastas. You know, it was about a 5,500 foot pass, but it was a pass. You could see it, and I can still hike up passes. You know, with backpacks on. What the heck?
Well, the weather looked pretty good in the picture you had.
It wasn't.
Oh, okay.
Fairbanks, that's our show for today. You have a great day, and I will see you on Friday, Mr. Nugent. Thank you so much, sir.
You're quite welcome.